Cool. Did you guys know, or hands up if you knew, that there's unicorns in the Bible? I was having coffee with a mate once, and we were just, he's not a Christian, and he asked some cool, curious questions, and he's pondering and wondering, and he'd seen something on Facebook or something, and was like, oh, dude, you know there's unicorns in the Bible? And I was like, oh, that doesn't sound right. But I don't have it all memorized, so can't definitively say no. But it did get me thinking a lot after that, like, where could he have got that from, and is that true? So a quick Google told me it was true from a certain angle. If we jump forward to a couple of verses from the King James Version, Numbers 23:22 says, God brought them out of Egypt. He hath, as it were, the strength of a unicorn. Psalm 22:21, save me from the lion's mouth, for thou hast heard me from the horns of the unicorns. Isaiah 34:7, and the unicorns shall come down with them, and the bullocks with the bulls, and their land shall be soaked with blood, and their dust made fat with fatness. That's my favourite one. So it got me thinking, I was like, well, you can answer this in a simple way. It's like, okay, this is the King James Version, and when I look at my version, it doesn't seem to come up. But it does get you wondering, like, why was that ever in there, and what could that have meant? So I jumped on Blue Letter Bible. Now, if you haven't used Blue Letter Bible before, it's a really cool app that you can get on your phone. And it has the whole Bible on it and different translations. But when you click on each verse, it gives you the Hebrew or the Greek for that verse. And so that's what I did, and I went to this verse here, and I found the word that was being used, which was rahem, meaning wild oxen. And then if you click on the word, it gives you a little bit more information, and it says probably the great arochs or wild bulls, which are now extinct. The exact meaning is not totally known. So this rahem or rahem is likely an auroch, which is an animal that the original audience would have been very familiar with. And likely extinct in the 17th century, but very prominent between the 1400s and 700 BC. So very well known. It was an animal of great strength and a prominent horn at the time. So this confusion stems entirely from translation history. The identification, the reason it ended up at unicorn was to do with the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible. So the Hebrew Bible was pretty well all polished and finished a few centuries before Jesus came. And within that sort of silent period, as more people were starting to speak Greek, they translated the whole Hebrew Bible into Greek because that was what most people were speaking. And so where Greek translated, they changed rahem to monokeros, meaning one-horned. This Greek term eventually became the unicorn in English Bibles. And so the King James Version translators didn't realise, obviously, that unicorns were going to be these mythical creatures as we now understand them. And so, yeah, since 1382, English translations had consistently rendered rahem as unicorn. So what was the rahem actually at this time? Well, modern scholars recognise it as an animal from the ox family, as we saw in that photo, not the horse-like mythical creature that the word unicorn now means. The biblical reference is attempting to use rahem for ploughing, suggests it was an undomesticated ox. Biblical texts describe it as having two horns, further confirming that it wasn't even that single-horned creature of legend at that time. The biblical passages consistently emphasize this animal's formidable power. References to the rahem typically highlight the creature's strength as an expression of God's ruling power. Appearing in context where divine might is being celebrated or where danger is being depicted. The unicorn of medieval Christian tradition, with its elaborate symbolism and mythical qualities that we don't even have on our earth right now, owes more to more classical sources and imaginative elaboration than anything actually biblical. In summary, the word was not chosen to represent a mythical pink horse with one horn. So it's an important point where we understand here that words matter less than how we picture words functioning. Obviously, when I put that photo up at the start, we all start picturing something very quickly. And when I say the word unicorn, we all go to that picture very fast. So it got me thinking after that is where else might we have a unicorn problem? when we're reading our Bible. Maybe it's slavery. Slavery was both used to justify slavery. The Bible was used to justify slavery, but then the Bible was also used to abolish slavery. I think someone worked out that they had a unicorn problem at that time. What about women's role in church, submission in marriage, or even how we approach tough verses like David being told to get 200 foreskins so that he could marry a daughter, or Psalm 137:9, happy is the one who seizes your infants and dashes them against the rocks. Another interesting one is love. Do we have a unicorn, or have we had a unicorn problem on the word love? We'll get to that in a moment. This is why study is important, right? That we have to remember the Bible is written for us and not to us. There are fresh challenges that come to the Bible as our history changes with time, as our context changes. There's fresh challenges that come to the Bible and fresh questions that our friends and family might come and ask of us of the Bible. But there's also fresh revelations to us, but still God's original intent. Let's look at an example of that at the moment, which is the word love. So love, the classical Greek employed four words for love. Eros being this erotic, sensual love. Philia being family, friendship, or non-sexual love. Agape being action on behalf of another. And storge, which does not really appear in either the Septuagint or New Testament, but is similar to the word philia. Notably, agape is very, very sparse in biblical Greek, but in the New Testament, it's used 250 times. So for a word that was very rarely used, but existed, but very rarely used in classical Greek, it's used a lot in the New Testament. Philia is used about 50 times, and the other two aren't really used at all. So very interestingly, agape, often regarded as a shortened form of agapesis, which occurs in other writings like Aristotle's writings, but very rarely in other things. In secular Greek writing, it appears for the first time really in the first century AD. The term becomes very prominent in Christians' vocabulary, and it stems from its adoption by the Septuagint translators, so those Greek translators, rather than from classical Greek translators. What's cool, though, is that because agape was really seldom used and carried a very non-specific connotation at the time, it became available for us to designate sort of our definition, or the New Testament author's definition to agape, being this unmerited love that God demonstrates to humanity through Christ's redemptive love, love for everyone, and God's love. Love itself was radically redefined in the New Testament through Jesus himself, understood in light of his ministry and crucifixion, rather than just a mere continuation of the Old Testament teaching. Agape expresses this spontaneous, creative, caring, sacrificial love that reflects God's nature and extends to undeserving people through Christ. We know how to love God and to love people, not by the world's definition, but by God's definition, grounded in his word, as revealed to us as we study his scriptures. Okay, it comes alive the more we understand our scriptures. And this was quite radical at the time. If you take yourself historically, if you can do that back to 2,000 years ago, we're living in a very, very different time. At that time, it was almost fit and proper for a male to send a letter to his wife and who's pregnant. If you give birth to a female, throw them out. I don't want them. I just want a male. And so the knock on Christianity in even the early church was it was actually quite a feminine religion, because it was full of so many women, because the Christians were the ones who would take in these female children coming in. So if you put yourself into that context, what most people's picture of love was not this sacrificial, self-giving, sacrificial love given to the person who cannot speak for themselves. It was, at that time, very sexual, very radical, very self-loving, all those sorts of things in some ways, but perhaps not too different to the world that we live in today. Matthew 22:37, and then again in 39, Jesus replied, "You must love," or "you must agape the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, and all your mind. A second is equally important, love your neighbor as yourself." The term "you shall love" is agapeo, which is just a verb of the noun agape, which is a doing word of that agape love, okay? Love in action. It is profound, selfless, and unconditional love. So It's really all I had prepped, but do you see that? Do you see how we can use our study of the word to actually maybe counter arguments that might come at us? Our Bible can withstand anything and everything. When my friend said that to me over coffee, I was like, it doesn't sound right, and there's got to be a reason here. I know my Bible stands up to anything, okay? And if you dig a bit deeper, it always can. But also when we take that depth to our scriptures and study a little bit more, we can even, you know, just like the word love, it can reveal to us a greater truth than what our own definitions, our own biases that we put into our Bible. So I just want to demonstrate that today. Just a little bit of, well, I'll call it fun because it was fun for me. Study of how I would, come to a question that seems confusing. What I might even start off at, what was Google? But then go on to other things like commentaries and Blue Letter Bible, which is an awesome resource to sort of kickstart some study into some of the Hebrew or the Greek that can just reveal maybe a depth to your scriptures that perhaps you haven't had the journey of just yet. So that's all from me. We are going to go now into a message from Shane Willard. Mitch, anything else to add on that?
Awesome. Yeah.